This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, mobile web development, coffee, and minivans. Show is hosted, as always, by Marco Arment. He is the creator of Instapaper, WeDon'tSay.com. And by me, I am Dan Benjamin. This is episode number 85 for Monday, July 9th, 2012. We have some lovely sponsors we would love to tell you about. FreshBooks.com, Hover.com, and Squarespace.com. Stay tuned, and you will hear more about them. We would also like to thank Infinite Kind for sponsoring our bandwidth for this month. They're the makers of SyncSpace, enabling multiple people to sketch ideas together wherever they are. InfiniteKind.com. How you doing, Marco? Marco Arment.
Good. A little tired, you know, baby stuff.
What's going on? How is that baby?
He is awake. Frequently.
Yeah.
Otherwise, very good.
They do that, waking
yeah,
up.
Yeah, I kind of got that impression. Yeah, pretty good, though. He's getting bigger, and yeah, he's starting to, like, give feedback. Like, he can smile at me and laugh and track objects. So, you know, that's all. That you know, a few weeks ago, he pretty much could just, like, look cute, cry, and poop. But now he can do more things, so it's great. He's adding to his wheelhouse, as you and Merlin would say.
Right. He's not so close to the metal anymore.
Something like that. I don't know.
I don't know what that means. I have to ask Merlin.
Yeah. I can only listen to him at 1X. Man, there was so much good Merlin stuff this week. Because not only, you know, he was on his show, which was great, and, you know, as usual. And then he's on Gruber's show for like 2 hours. And then he also recently did a Mac power user thing that I haven't listened to yet.
Oh, yeah.
And it takes me forever to get through this because everything else I listen to at about 1.5x usually.
Mm.
And I have to listen to Merlin at 1x. Oh, Roderick on the Line, another one.
There you go.
Listen to a lot of Merlin this week.
I guess he's not too concerned with overexposure then.
I mean, you could never have too much Merlin. You can just not have enough time to get through all the Merlin. That's the only risk, really.
That's the risk.
You can't have too much. I haven't even heard the new "Look Nice Today." That's another thing that happened this week. We save that for long car trips because Tiff and I like to listen together. And we haven't had one of those yet since July 2nd.
Ah.
Yeah. So, anyway, got some follow-up from last week. Some FU, as John Siracusa would say.
Yeah, the FU.
First of all, the last... I'm declaring this the last follow-up on the copyright argument I made a few episodes ago. That if you pirate stuff, you should at least admit that, you know, it's wrong. You're doing it knowing it's pirating, not because of some, like, morally just reason. So I got a question, which is the last one I will address on this topic, from, Janis or Giannis Kuchars? I'm sorry. In one of the last shows, Marco talked about that it's not right to justify their own piracy by the lack of the content providers to make it available everywhere. You can tell this is not an English first language speaker. Here's the situation. The new Lost Steve Jobs interview everyone talks about and that you recommend in your blog is only available in English-speaking countries and not in Germany, where I live. Am I supposed to miss out because it is not available here right now? Must I wait X months to watch it? Till they put it out here, probably even dubbed with some bad translations? The answer is yes.
Yes. I thought it was going to say the Lost Steve Jobs interview is neither lost nor an interview. Discuss. I thought that's how the email was going to go.
That's not bad at all. No, you know, the answer is yeah. Are you supposed to go without it to watch? I mean, yeah, if you want to be right, yes. That's... Copyright owners can dictate how and when their work is available. It's as simple as that. I mean, technically, yes, you can pirate it before then if you can find a copy of it online. You know, that is possible, but that doesn't make it right. That doesn't excuse you from the moral weight of that. And, you know, the moral weight of pirating something really isn't that heavy on most of us. I don't think most of us care, honestly, but at least recognize that that is not a justification. That does not excuse you from pirating it. So my whole argument there was not that nobody should pirate anything ever because it's so bad. My argument is at least admit that you're pirating it and that there's no morally justified reason for almost any piracy. that you know you try to justify it to excuse yourself from it, but that really is crap. So that, anyway, that's my argument. So we should probably talk about the corrupt App Store binaries issue.
Do you think, is that worth mentioning?
It was pretty big.
It's probably the biggest thing Apple has done in a while.
The master trolling of stealing my topic. That was amazing. Devoting almost his entire show to my topic this week, knowing that he would beat me to it with his Friday time slot. That was awesome.
Well, this is Marco, a show for developers. I think, again, we should state that once in a while. Some people think this is a development show or a show about development. It is not. It is a show for developers. And this topic, I think, is a quintessential topic for us to talk about, not only because you are the hero of this whole situation, but because you really did a lot to bring attention to it. And by the way, we have to thank our friend Philip Elmer DeWitt, friend of the show, for crowning you the hero of Apple's Appageddon.
That was a pretty cool article.
He's great. He comes up with the best nicknames for people. Of course, I'm biased because he calls me the king of Apple Talk Radio. I'm not sure I qualify to be the king of anything, but I will pretend. But I love this title for you, the hero, Marco Arment, the hero of Apple's Appageddon. And he has a nice piece on this. And basically, maybe you can summarize what happened here. What did Apple do? And how did they attempt to fix it?
I'm not going to go over too much of the detail of what the issue actually was, because it's been covered everywhere in the universe, as well as my site and probably your site and everybody else's site. So,
just a quick summary, a one sentence
run. Very brief. The issue was that Apple was issuing corrupt binaries between July 3rd and 5th for apps that were updated, apps that had updates published between July 3rd and 5th, roughly, for not all, but for many of the apps updated during that time. Apple was issuing binaries that would immediately, and the cause of the issue was something related to their FairPlay DRM system. And I don't think we know any more details than that, but they were somehow missigning or corrupting these binaries when applying, which happens after developers submit the apps. First it took them a while to acknowledge and fix it, but then once they did, I think in the evening of July 5th is when they finally fixed it. They had an interesting fix later that night. You know, the problem was that all of us developers who had these apps affected, and my update was affected, and a number of other updates, large and small, were affected, even one of the Angry Birds. Their fix was that they reissued the update as if it were a new update for all these affected apps, which forced people's phones to re-download them even if they already had them, which is actually a very clever update, because what that does, before, the only way to recover from this if you had the corrupt binary was to delete the app and re-download it from the App Store. But that's no good for apps that store data locally that don't have it backed up anywhere. So like, if you have like a drawing app and it has like its own little collection of local drawing files that you've created in it, and if you haven't synced your iPad or iPhone in a while and you have to delete and reinstall that app, then you're going to lose anything you've drawn or created in there that you haven't backed up, or that was created after your last backup. So that's no good. There's also no convenient way to restore just one app from a backup. You'd have to lose everything and all apps from the last backup. So that's no good either. So it was a pretty crappy solution to have to delete and reinstall apps. So what Apple did by repushing the updates as new updates avoids that whole problem. And because it makes people's phones just download the fixed versions as if they were updates, so that people don't have to delete and reinstall. Good. The other issue of what they should have done or what they did to fix this was, what do you do about all these one-star reviews? Because everyone left one-star reviews saying this app crashes on launch, or I can't open the app. What happened? This version is broken. And as a developer, I put like a little note as soon as I knew about this problem. I was talking on Twitter about it, saying don't download the app. I went on the App Store and updated the description, which showed up like a couple hours into it, saying, don't update this version yet. I'm working on an issue, et cetera. The problem is nobody reads those things. And you know, not everybody who uses the app follows me on Twitter. And not everybody who updates the app reads the description before they update. And a lot of people updated before I put that description in there anyway. So there were still tons of people with all these affected apps who left one-star reviews because they were upset. And that's understandable. I still think going to support first would have been nice. But oh well. So what do you do with all these one-star reviews? So I went through, as John Syracuse had talked about extensively in his show that stole my topic, I went through and did the report a concern link on all of the ones that were reporting this crash after the issue was fixed, basically saying, here's what this issue was. It's your fault, Apple. I don't think I should be penalized for this, you know, in a nicer way, in more words. But that's what I wrote. And as far as I can tell, none of those were removed. And it's been a few days now. So I think if they were going to be removed, they would have been. So as far as I can tell, Apple ignored those requests. By pushing a new version of the app, though, they reset to nothing. They cleared all of the reviews for that current version. So now all those one-star reviews don't show up in the current version reviews section, but they do still show up in the star averages, in the little histogram of the count of how many reviews for each star level, and in the reviews for all versions tab in the iTunes interface.
So a minute, are they still visible then? Or are they?
Yeah, they're still visible. Okay. They're just hidden by default most of the time. Or in the iOS app, I don't think the iOS app distinguishes between current version and all versions, but it just the old ones are just further down. You know, these reviews are still here. Now, I was able to go on Twitter to the Instapaper account and say, hey, these reviews are hurting me. I'd really appreciate it if you guys would leave a review today. And tons of Instapaper fans went and left a review because they wanted to support me and they felt badly about what happened. So I got more reviews that day than any other day I've ever... Like, it was crazy. Before that, the version had something like 31 one-star reviews and about 32 five-star reviews. And I asked for those reviews, and then a few hours later, it had like 400 five-star reviews and still the same number of one-star reviews. So it worked for me. That was awesome. However, it doesn't work for small app developers who have smaller followings or apps that just don't sell that many copies. So Apple's fix did help in the way that, you know, it avoided data loss for people having to delete and reinstall the app. It cleared out the reviews from being visible on that current versions tab. But because the reviews are still there, it still is going to hurt apps that don't have a lot of reviews in general. Like if you only have 7 reviews on your app and 3 of them say this version crashes immediately upon launch, that's pretty bad. You know, that's really, really not good. So I do think Apple should consider deleting those reviews. However, it's worth asking yourself, you know, do this, or, you know, this, some big company should do this. This policy is stupid. Why is it this way? But if you think about this, how would they delete only the reviews from this? Now, if you think, okay, so could they just do like a delete, and could they delete all one-star reviews from any app updated from July 3rd through 5th for the current version?
Well, I mean, I think
that has problems.
Well, it does. I mean, the main problem that I can think of is, what if legitimate reviews were posted during that time from somebody who hadn't downloaded a corrupted build?
Right, exactly. Like what if that version, yeah, once the person got it launching, what if it had big problems that they wanted to report? You know, like that, you can't just blanket delete all the reviews from that time period. Apple also can't tell who got a bad copy and who didn't. Really, and probably in any reasonable way. Maybe they could go through like some massive logs and everything, but they probably wouldn't. So, you know, is it fair to delete all negative reviews for this one problem that they might not be talking about? What if you delete all reviews from that time period, which is kind of what they did by hiding them all? But, you know, if they actually delete all those reviews, well, wouldn't customers get pretty 3-day period during which if they wrote a review, it's just gone for no good reason? So it's kind of a a weird problem. And I think maybe that's why they didn't delete these reviews, because it's difficult to do that in an algorithmic way that would be fair. Now, one more thing on this, and hopefully I can get past this topic after this. But one more thing is that now the apps that have been repushed so that they re-downloaded to everybody, it looks like there's some kind of bug or side effect to that process that people can't leave reviews now for the current versions. So I now have an app that is unreviewable. And anybody who, like, until I ship another version, until I ship an update, nobody can review my app. And that's true for all these apps. Now, I was thinking, like, jokingly, is that maybe a good thing? Like, is there any way that having an unreviewable app might actually be a positive thing? I was thinking, if you timed it such that, like, if your app had this corrupt update, and that was a version that changed things people didn't like, like if you removed a feature or something, or if you like raised a price or added in-app purchase for something. Like imagine if Instacast 2.0 that had that in-app purchase that everybody hated, imagine if that was corrupted and had all the reviews reset and then nobody could review that app. Like if I were them, I would sit on that and not release an update for like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Just to let all the hate die down and then release the update. But anyway, hopefully this will all be moot. Everyone will release updates that can be reviewed, and we'll stop talking about this and we'll forget about it.
This is just a tricky situation, and it's actually really amazing to me that this is the first time that we have ever seen anything like this from Apple in the years that they've been running the App Store. Like, this kind of thing happens all the time everywhere else, you know, whether it's corrupted downloads or just other issues in general. This is the first, I think, major glitch that Apple's run into.
Well, and I should point out also, I've gotten numerous reports during this time that these were all still crashing and new apps were still being issued that were corrupt. I got, of course, tons of email from people, and I was actually asking for it, from people who were being affected by this, whose apps were affected by this, so I could compile that big list. And what I heard from a lot of people is that this problem, while it was happening in much higher numbers and a much higher frequency on July 3rd through 5th, it had also happened in February and on June 20th. And it just only affected a small number of apps. But I heard from numerous developers about specifically June 20th being a problematic day, and also some various days in February that this happened to them, with all the exact same symptoms, the exact same fair play error messages and everything. So it doesn't sound like this was the first time they've ever had problems. It sounds like this was just the worst time they had problems, and it was big enough that they had to fix it. And I don't know if the previous ones were fixed or if they were just ignored, if it was this problem kind of building up over time and then something hit a limit somewhere or some server was given too many requests and something bad happened. I don't know. But this, you know, the App Store is not perfect. Just usually the bugs are relatively contained, and so they don't usually affect hundreds of apps. This one clearly did, though, and it affected hundreds of apps in a very high-profile time, and a whole bunch of the press was talking about it. So that I think is why this became a big deal and a big story, because it was just the worst time this ever happened. But it was not, as far as I can tell, it was not the first time this happened.
First time, though, that somebody like you was affected and could become the hero.
Exactly the right place and the right time to do that, because Instapaper, as far as I knew, Instapaper was the first, it was in the first time that this problem was live. So it was approved on the evening of the 3rd, and the vast majority of the apps that had this problem were approved on July 4th. But a few apps were approved late in the day on July 3rd, and they had this problem. So as far as I could tell, Instapaper was one of the first apps that had it, and it annoyed me enough. And I had a big enough audience on Twitter to report to me things like the fair play error messages that weren't happening on my devices or that I couldn't see or didn't think to look for, and various iTunes errors. So like it happened to, you know, I think this problem helped get fixed quickly because it happened to a high profile app with lots of nerd followers, written by a guy with a nerd blog.
Yeah.
Early on in the process. So it was a whole bunch of things adding up like that, that caused this to happen, that caused me to be like the reference article about it. and that caused lots of other sites to copy my article.
So that's probably topic number two. So how do you think overall, what's your feeling on Apple's solution for this? How did they handle it? Do you like this? Do you hate this? Do you find that it's just the best that they can do? If you've been noticing that Marco has been breaking up a little bit, it is not his fault. It is also not our fault. It is somewhere in between Marco and I.
There is Microsoft's fault.
There is a Skype super node that is handling our connection that, regardless of how good Marco or my connection is, will still create a problem. And we use Skype because it has the best dynamic range over anything, and we've tested everything else. And I apologize if you hear Marco cutting out a little bit. But now we've acknowledged it, and people won't hate you.
Thank you. That's very important.
Okay.
All right.
Well, at least they won't hate you for that reason.
Can we cut most of that out? I hate podcasts about Skype problems.
I've already cut it out. All they heard is the statement we just released.
Oh, thank God. All right.
That's all gone.
Those are so boring. It's almost as bad as podcasts about podcasting.
Which is what we're doing now.
Right. All right. So let's move on.
All right.
Do you actually want to do it for a sponsor?
Sure, we could do the first sponsor. We've got three great sponsors today. The first one that I'd like to tell you guys about is FreshBooks. These guys have a really, really great service. What do they do? They're the fastest way to track time, organize your expenses, and what I feel is most importantly, invoice your clients. These guys have such a cool service, and we use them, and I've been using them for years here, and eventually they became a sponsor, and I love when that happens. But let me tell you a little bit about how I use FreshBooks. I send out invoices. When someone sponsors a show, we send them an invoice. I do all of this through FreshBooks, and it's totally painless. You create them an account, and it automatically lets you start sending invoices, and it does all of the dirty work for you. It'll send the invoice out to them by email. They can click a link that they get in the email, and they see it right there on your little customized FreshBooks page. They see your logo. They see all the stuff you want to do. Then they can print the invoice out. They can download it as a PDF. They can do whatever they need to do, and you know that they have seen your invoice because it records those that activity. So you don't ever have to wonder, did my client get the invoice? Have they seen it? You can see that they saw it. You can see that they've logged in. They even can see all of their previous invoices that you've ever sent them. They can get a running total. They can see, and when they do pay you, and by the way, they can pay you online through FreshBooks, you can check a little box and hit a little submit button, and it'll send them an email letting them know that you've received the payment. So it's all automated. You don't have to, and that's my favorite part of this, because it eliminates all that extra communication and did you get it? Did you see it? It's just done. And they say that you will get paid faster. That's what they claim. I can tell you in my experience, you absolutely do. Really great stuff. You can try it free for 30 days. When you try it free for 30 days, by the way, you have access to the whole system. You can create all the sub accounts. You can track time. You can do everything. It's a full-blown account at whatever level you want. Try it free for 30 days. You go to freshbooks.com to do that. Thanks very much to those guys for making the show possible.
They're good. I like them.
They make it simple.
All right. So one more bit of follow up to John Siracusa. He was talking about, and I don't think we actually talked about this on the show, with Matt Gemmell's post about responding to app reviews, about letting developers respond to app reviews and why that would be a bad idea. Did we talk about that? I know I blogged about it. I don't think it made it onto our show. All right. So there's a great post by Matt Gemmell. About how, you know, Google just added to the Google Play Store, or is adding, the ability for developers to respond to the publicly posted user reviews of apps. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the dysfunctional app review system the dysfunctional app store reviews, and, you know, just quite how weird they are, quite how bad they are in many ways. But they're also good in many ways. And, you know, it's tough to come up with a better system, because any kind of change to the way it works, or any better system or more features that are added to it, also adds a potential for abuse. And so, and Matt Gemmell's post was very good, basically saying, like, even if you're the kind of developer who would do a very good job of responding to app reviews, this probably isn't the kind of system that you want. Like, you probably don't want to do that. It's probably not good for you or your apps or your customers. In its entirety. You know, there might be a few cases, there might be a few reviews where you'd love to be able to respond. But you know, probably you probably don't want that on all of them because there's a lot of possible side effects. And one of them that I think is interesting and worth talking about is, you know, you got to assume there's hundreds of thousands of registered developers in the App Store. Not every developer is nice or ethical. And in fact, there's a very large amount of developers who are trying as much as they can to scam the system. And that's just, you know, that's part of doing life. That's a part of life when you're in like this kind of gold rush market with the potential to make lots of money. So if Apple added the ability for developers to respond publicly to reviews, that would cause some problems, certainly. You know, you'd certainly get what Mac Emmel was describing with like the weird social problems with interacting with people on that level. And it wouldn't look good for anybody. But John Siracusa mentioned what if developers could respond privately. Now that, again, if we think of like, you know, what would Panic do? Panic would do it well, and they would respond privately, and they'd be really nice about it, and everyone would wish they would respond as well as Panic does. But everyone's not Panic, unfortunately. And so I think like with private feedback to reviews, I'd be worried about developers like threatening people. Wouldn't that, like, if you think about it, like, wouldn't there be a class of developers like the funny junk lawyer guy? Like, wouldn't there be a class of developers who would respond to every one-star review privately saying, you better change that or we're going to sue you? You know, like, and even if Apple, like, hid their email address from the first person so you couldn't, like, so there's really no real way to reach them, a lot of these people's usernames on the App Store are also their Twitter names. Or if you do a Google search for them, you can find their blog really easily. So you'd still be able to find the people. And even if you just send out like a blanket response, like a cease and desist, update your review, we're going to sue you response to everyone who gave you a one star, the people might not realize that you don't know who they are. So they might still think, you know, the intimidation would still work. And you better not talk about this. You better not tell anybody that we threatened you or we'll sue you some more. You know, like that, I stuff like that would happen if it was all in private. So that's not a good solution either. So I don't think there is a good solution to this problem in the system it has now. Now I think a good improvement that Apple needs to make, which doesn't have to do with responding, is how they decide which reviews to show, how they order them, and basically how they're policed. As far as I can tell, the reporter concern link works about half the time that I think it should. Not counting this whole one star for the crashing issue. Before that, I think about half the time that I report a problem on one of my reviews that I think is legitimate, about half the time Apple agrees and about half the time they don't. Now, that, you know, that's one part of the problem. I think a bigger part of the problem is the way they're sorted. Now, in the little dialogue that reporter concern brings up that tries to dissuade you from reporting a concern, it says that if you click the not helpful thing next to each review, that it will show it further down the list. That actually is not true. Because as we've said before in the show, reviews currently are sorted by number of helpful votes descending, regardless of how many unhelpful votes those answers have. So the problem with that is, like, you know, if you have a review that has like, you know, 10 of 70 people found this helpful, and the next one is 11 of 12 people found this helpful, then the first one will be ranked higher. You know, it's so something that a handful of people agree with, even if the vast majority of your customers don't, will be on top. Same thing happens with the podcast, and, you know, you see it all over the App Store or the iTunes Store. So I think there are improvements Apple has to make there. I'd also be interested to see some kind of like almost like a page rank system for reviewers. Like some kind of way to evaluate the
like
quality of
a
reviewer. Yeah. So like if this reviewer only goes around one starring everything, then maybe their reviews aren't worth as much as somebody who has a more varied input. You know? Or if you go around one starring everything and there's one app that you five star, maybe you're the developer of that app. And Apple knows that. You know, Apple can make that connection on the back end, you know. So like that's like there are things they should be doing to help, like, you know, maybe there should be like a hell banning system where like if somebody doesn't I mean, it doesn't even have to be that fancy, but like if somebody is deemed to be not having worthwhile reviews, don't tell them that. Just don't display their reviews. You know, it's as simple as that. You know, because this is a giant piece of social software, the App Store. And if you've ever been a part of forums or things like Stack Overflow, any kind of online social community with software in place to structure it and to show it and to run it, you always can see that there's no simple answer to a lot of these things. But generally speaking, you need some kind of moderation and filtering. These things won't police themselves. And the App Store system, it seems like Apple has like one intern running the entire App Store reviews system, like the customer reviews. It just seems like there's no effort being put into that. And that probably isn't true. It probably responding to all those reporter concern links is a big deal. But it just seems like they don't give a crap about improving the system. Now, in iOS 6, they have changed it in ways I probably can't discuss, but also because I'm not that familiar with them because I haven't looked too hard yet, but now it involves the Facebook likes somehow. I don't know. They mentioned that in the keynote. I don't think that actually really changes it much, though. It just replaces the upvote system with it. It replaces the up-down vote with an up-only, and it's a Facebook like, as far as I can tell from the little that I've seen so far. But anyway, the app review system, you know, the star reviews, I'm not talking about reviewing apps for approval for publishing. I'm talking about the star review system. It is very problematic. There's lots of trouble with it, but I don't think that a lot of developers to respond will solve more problems than it creates. Anyway. All right.
It is a tough one. It really is tough. And that's why when you think about this, you think Apple couldn't have possibly anticipated all of these problems. It's almost like, I mean, it really is in so many ways to me when I hear you describing the potential problems of each one of these solutions. It really reminds me so much of comments on websites just again and again. And why some people say, I don't want any comments. Other people say, oh, I don't care. There's only one guy that I know who really, really handles comments the way that, you know, you referenced what would Panic do? How would Panic handle this? They would do it right. Well, you know, Horace does a really good job with comments. He's actively involved in the comments on asimco.com. Like, he's really involved. Like, he reads them. He'll write posts based around questions asked in the comments. I mean, he's super, but almost nobody else really wants to do that.
Right. It has a lot to do with your audience. You know, I think people who go to Horace on a regular basis are going to like the kind of thing he does. And I think they're the kind of people who, you know, he writes the kind of content that would attract people who would leave the right kind of comments for that content. Does that make sense?
Definitely.
Because that is not true for everybody. Like, I think if it's something like you know, John Gruber's site on Daring Fireball, he writes the kind of content that the people who read it would leave bad comments. You know, because, you know, when you write about Apple stuff and the industry and there's a lot of opinion involved, you're going to get a whole lot of people who read that frequently because it's accessible to them. It's, you know, it's opinion. It's about things they know and like. It's easy to understand, but who disagree with you. In Horace's case, he writes content that is mostly just data and then drawing conclusions that are very well supported by that data. So he's only going to get the kind of readers who are going to understand that data for the most part, or who are going to be able to look at those graphs and come to the same conclusions he does. And then the comments he gets are from people who either appreciate that or have spotted something he hasn't and are suggesting a correction or an amendment. And that's exactly what he wants, because his posts are about data. You know, anytime you have mostly opinion, you're not going to have that situation. So anyway, I want to move on to another piece of feedback that I think is worth thinking about. So we got a question from Abhi Beckert. And a few episodes ago, last episode, we were talking about the Apple Podcasts app and the potential for them to charge money for podcasts and how realistic that was and how that would actually work. So Abby Beckert asks, why can't podcast sales work exactly the same as newsstand, which is even bigger, or podcasts are even bigger? I gladly spend an hour each week listening to Build and Analyze, or 9 hours listening to Hypercritical. There is nothing in newsstand that I'd read free. So I would pay more for a good podcast than anything currently available in newsstand. And I reckon podcasts would have better content if they made $70,000 a week in 99-cent sales. So I agree with Abby that, yeah, of course, you know, making 70 grand a week from a bunch of 99-cent sales would be awesome. I would love that. That would be amazing. Especially if you didn't have to pay for hosting. Like if Apple was hosting all these podcast files, that would be even better.
It would.
That would be great. However, most people don't think this way. Most people don't value their content or their apps this way. You know, that's people will spend $8 on dessert at a restaurant that they will enjoy for at most 10 minutes. People will go and complain endlessly about paying $3 for an iOS app that they'll use every day for 3 years. It's just people don't think about, or they don't assign that value mentally to content that they consume, usually, especially in new media content that is mostly developed and distributed on the internet, where on the internet everything is free or pirated. So I think there might be one or two would pay $1 a week for this podcast and for any podcast, but I think those numbers are going to be pretty small. Overall, I think it's going to be very, very few people. The reason why advertising is still the primary method of monetization for most online content is because it just pays more. It's simple as that. I'm sure, Dan, you would love to have everybody just paying you directly, and you would never have to arrange another ad buy again. You never have to coordinate with advertisers. You probably would save a whole bunch of time. But ads just pay better. It's as simple as that. There's a lot of people who, but there's a heck of a lot more who can't or won't, but will listen to an ad and will deliver value potentially to your advertisers. So advertisers are willing to pay more in general for things like this. So as much as I would love a direct payment system, I don't think we're going to get one.
No, I'm with you. I think you're right. And again, I mean, just to kind of further your point and clarify, there are a number of networks that I know of that they're entirely listener sponsored, you know, and certainly if I just said to everybody, hey, if you like these shows, you know, give us $1 a week for every show you listen to, you know, something like that could potentially fund some of what we do. But there are a lot of costs. And like you said, you know, advertisers, I think, are a great way because we try really, really hard to pick and work with advertisers who are going to make sense for the audience. And I mean, obviously, it's still an interruption in the flow of the show. I get that. But if we're telling you about something that might be useful and the advertiser's happy because the audience is finding it useful, you know, but man, do I spend a lot of time working on, like, people think that it might be easy. It is not. I spend a tremendous amount of time, way, way, way more time than I spend on the air, you know, doing sales, talking to sponsors, approaching new sponsors, responding to sponsorship inquiries. I mean, and just that whole managing that whole process. I mean, I'm hiring for someone to help me manage that process because it is in and of itself, it is a full-time job. I'm not even just talking about the pure sales aspect of it either, just the management stuff. It's a lot of work. So yeah, the idea of like having someone who's like, yeah, here's a buck. I mean, we have the donate link on 5x5. I don't talk about it a lot. We have the app, which is a great way for people to support too. But again, I mean, that's not what Apple is thinking about doing. From what the bird told me.
Makes sense. All right. Moving on. Got a question from a guy who gave me a pronunciation guide to his name. Thank you for that.
Love that.
It is Thighs Nix from a few weeks ago. And he said, he was talking about on my blog how I linked to Phil Getson and his fear that all Windows Phone apps will look the same. You add that iPhone apps using UIKit do so as well, but customers have come to expect non-standard designs from high-profile apps. Instapaper looks like a fairly standard iPhone app too, in my opinion, while the competition, such as Pocket, does not to a lesser extent. Do you see this as a problem, and have you looked into changing this? Yes. All right, another question from Kenny Long. Tweet from MG Siegler. MG Siegler tweeted the other day in response to somebody. He said, I'd imagine it's a foregone conclusion at this point that Twitter buys one of the Read It Later services. Perfect mesh. So Kenny Long asks in response to this, Marco, do you agree with him? It seems more likely that a company with venture funding like Pocket would have more urgency to be acquired. But does your dependence on Twitter's mobile integration mean that you'd have to explore this option for Instapaper if Twitter was truly interested? All right, there's kind of two questions here. And I don't want to talk, you know, I talk a lot about my competitors in this show. For the first like year and a half of the show, I didn't talk about them at all because I was afraid to. Then I started getting more competitors, so it started becoming relevant. And so I started talking about them more. And I don't want to talk about them too much here. And I think I've picked on both Readability and Pocket enough. So I don't mean this as a picking on thing. I really mean this in a business way, in what's relevant to the show and what this question's about. So Pocket is currently at a stage in their VC funding where they're probably already in the middle of raising their Series B, which is their second round of funding. Because their first round was over a year ago, I think, now. So they're usually your first round is meant to last you like a year and a half or 2 years, and that's about it. So they have hired the people they wanted to hire. They have grown the way they want to grow. So I would imagine they're burning through that money pretty quickly, and they're probably surprising if they announce any day now a new round of funding. So the question was whether... Whether a VC-funded company like Pocket would have, quote, more urgency to be acquired. Now, a VC-funded company, as long as they can keep raising money on favorable terms, they can avoid being acquired or even making a profit. As long as they're growing and as long as investors believe that they have more potential to grow, especially if they believe they have a lot more potential to grow, then they can keep raising more and more money on very favorable terms. Basically, in short, you give up very little of your company and your control over it, and they give you a lot more money. That's favorable terms. So
I like I like those. Who wouldn't those?
Like if you can, maybe the Series A might have been like 20 or 25% of the company, but if you can raise a Series B with giving away like another 10% of the company, and you can raise a lot more money, then those are generally good terms. Maybe you can avoid getting another board member, especially that would help too. Then you have fewer people to please and to deal with and to have control over you. No trouble raising this Series B money. So they're not going to have any pressure to be acquired by anybody for at least another year. Now, the question is what happens after that. So as any VC company goes, if they can keep growth going, they'll be fine. They'll be able to raise even more money or figure out how to make money themselves. Although still, I think when you have that kind of investor, a very slowly growing but slightly profitable company is not what they want. They want an exit. So they're probably going to be acquired at some point. I mean, it'd be very unlikely that they wouldn't. The question is under what terms? Because what happens, the VCs are going to shop them around to be acquired. Once they think that the growth phase is either over or slowing down, or if the VCs think that this is like a really ripe time to be acquired for some reason, and if they think they're not going to get a better time in the near future, they'll start shopping them around to their other companies and to their friends and to their associates. That's how these circles work. That's one of the reasons you get VC money, is because it puts you in this game where it makes you a hell of a lot more likely to be acquired than if you don't have VC money. Because if you don't have VC money, these people aren't constantly trying to work for you to get acquired, basically. So I'm sure Pocket will get acquired by somebody, probably within 2 years. That's my best guess. And Readability probably won't because they don't have VC funding. I probably won't because I don't have VC funding. That's just how it works. It's these are all probablys and maybes, but certainly with a lot of precedent to back them up.
Is that something that you want? I mean, is that something you would be interested in, or do you not want to even discuss that?
I don't really know. I haven't really honestly thought too much about it, because I've never gotten an offer that I thought was worth considering. So, you know, if I got a really good offer, maybe I'd consider it. I don't know. I really don't know. It would really depend on what the offer was and what the terms were. Like, if the terms were, I'd have to, you know, I'd be bought by the big company in Russia that bought Six Apart or whatever it was. And I'd have to move to Russia and work there for a couple of years on it. I probably wouldn't do that. So, you know, I really don't know. The option is not currently on the table for anybody. So it's not really something I can even consider, because there's no offers right now that I'm considering.
But you don't wake up every morning thinking, yeah, I gotta unload this thing.
No. Cause that isn't how I think. That's not why I built it. You know, I didn't build it to exit. I love exit. It's like sunset.
It's such a beautiful spin.
Oh yeah. I gotta say to you one more quick thing on the Twitter thing from last week. They really have a document called the Rules of the Road for developers. They actually use the phrase "the rules of the road." Is that for real?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is I'm so gonna try. Douchey. Isn't that douchey?
Yeah, it's well, it's
rules
I'll put
of
this,
the road.
I'll
I feel this. Like whenever like these often California cultured people, whenever these people. Whenever they add words to something, or they replace a direct word with a euphemism, I feel like there's like an implied condescension there. Like, why couldn't they just say rules? You know, that rules, that's fine, or terms, that's fine. Rules of the road, though, it kind of sounds like it sounds unnecessarily condescending. Is that just me?
No, I know exactly what you mean.
It's kind of hard to explain this feeling.
This is like what you would say to, you know, the high school student who screwed up one time's too many.
Exactly.
Let me sit you down and explain. You know, these are kind of the rules of the road for you.
Yeah, it's the kind of that's exactly it. It's the kind of thing that you would say to children who misbehave.
Yeah.
You know, not to people who are your quote partners.
Right. So here's, I have this into the show notes. You can see all the show notes for everything that we've been talking about. 5by5.tv/buildanalyze/85. It's 85th episode. This is on dev.twitter.com/terms/api-terms. So that's the URL. At the top, the title, Developer Rules of the Road. And then it says again, second head, Rules of the Road. And it talks about what they've done. It says, the second paragraph, we've come up with a set of developer rules of the road that describe the policies and philosophy around what type of innovation is permitted with the content and information shared on Twitter. The rules.
What type of innovation?
This whole
thing is ridiculous. The whole thing is written to confuse everybody into thinking that this is something it's not.
Marco, I'm going to allow some innovation here. And this is the kind of innovation I'll permit.
With these rules of the road.
Right. Don't do anything. This is what it says. The rules will evolve along with our ecosystem as developers continue to innovate and find new creative ways to use the Twitter API. So please check back periodically to see the most current version. Marco, don't do anything prohibited by the rules, but talk to us if you think we should make a change or give you an exception.
See, this is why I really like, at least Apple's communications tend to not use these kind of euphemistic tendencies. Like they tend to be a lot more direct with their language than what I see from most other companies, especially this kind of company. I respect that. Even when Apple is telling me something I don't like, they usually do so in a direct way that I think shows more respect for me. When I see this kind of attitude from Twitter, It looks to me, it gives me the impression that they don't respect me, that they don't respect the developers. Apple, I think, respects us, but just sometimes and in some ways doesn't care about us, which I respect that more. Like, I understand them not caring about something, about our concerns. That's fine. That isn't offensive to me. It might be inconvenient, but it's usually not offensive. But when you have this attitude this condescending attitude, or you know, trying to paper over what you're really meaning or what you're really doing, that is what bothers me and offends me, deeply offends me. I don't know. Maybe I'm too big of a fan of George Carlin.
But this is, I admit, this is a weird document in that way. But I think they're doing it. I think they're just trying to be
like this.
But they're just trying to be fun. They're just trying to be fun.
Yeah, right.
Trying to make it fun.
They're trying to just bend over, keep having fun.
There are, for the record, there are some very talented and fun and smart people at Twitter. I know a handful of them. But
sure,
then
every company has good people.
This kind of communication is, I think, easily misinterpreted. And maybe it's different. Maybe if you're in San Francisco, like, this makes sense to you. I don't know.
I mean, it makes sense to people. See, what is the reason why this spreads, and this is more of a Merlin topic, I'm sorry. The reason why this spreads so easily with company culture is because it's palatable to a lot of people. It's hard. I don't know why, because I've always been the kind of person who likes direct phrasing and direct communication. And even when it's uncomfortable, I would rather be direct than dance around something and be condescending. And so I don't really understand the kind of people, the kind of mindset that prefer this. But I have seen for my entire life that I'm in the minority here. And they are definitely in the majority.
Yeah.
No question. Way more people want, and they want to hear that, and they want to speak in that way when they have to speak something that's inconvenient for you. They would rather candy coat it and euphemize everything and equivocate all over the place. But because I don't understand that, because I'm not that kind of person, I also don't understand why people do it. Like, I don't get that at all. I feel like I'm an alien when I when I see people doing this and liking this and preferring this. I feel like do we speak the same language? Am I like, is Ohio that weird of a place to be from? Like, I don't know. Something is wrong. We're not speaking the same language on some level. It's like PR speak.
You know? I always wonder, because I hear this a lot, and I feel the same way as you. I feel like if there's an easier... I remember back when I was in college. I'm an English major. I have a technical writing degree. And I remember something that we had like Tech Writing 3 class. It was like the advanced class when you're a senior. And the teacher that taught that, Dr. Jones, he was always saying... Always, and this is a guy who's had a career doing tech writing, working for big businesses, working for software companies. I mean, this is what he did, and teaching this stuff. And he would always say, use the most simple, straightforward word you can possibly use. Use the least loaded word. Use the word that has the most clear meaning and the most basic understanding. And his favorite example for this was the word utilize. Utilize sounds great. Oh, I want to utilize this. Yeah. He says, you know what's a better word? Use.
Yep.
You know, and this was, you know, all the time, whenever he'd be grading our, you know, we'd go and we'd have like real world projects where we'd go out and we'd write a technical manual for some crappy mainframe software or something, because that's what you did back in the, you know, in the early 90s. And he would like, this is what the kind of stuff he would mark. He wasn't worrying about grammar at that level. He was like, why are you using these complicated? Use more basic words. And I read something like this, I'm not really sure. How do you permit innovation or prohibit it? It just seems strange. Know. It's a weird concept. It's like a Merlin concept.
These things don't make sense to me. I feel like it is not my language. Yeah. It does not make sense. I don't know.
We should probably do a second sponsor now.
Yeah.
You ready for it?
Let's do it.
And by the way, I don't know if I should tell people. Should I tell people what you IM me while I'm doing a sponsor or no?
Tell people what?
What you IM me when I'm doing a sponsor.
Well, oh yeah.
I don't know if I want to say.
Yeah, go for it.
Marco, no, I don't want to say it. I'll do a sponsor.
You can say it.
Now,
okay.
Our second sponsor today is Hover.com. And I'm going to make this simple for people. You go to hover.com/Dan sent me. You will get 10% off everything you do there. What can you do? You can register a really great domain name, .com, .net, whatever. They do all the, well, I don't, they don't do all the extensions. They do the good ones. They do .tv, they do .co, the ones you want. There are some ridiculous ones that they don't do. Promotional code is Dan sent me. You'll save 10%. This is, let me make it simple. If you want to register a domain, go to hover.com and register the domain there. That's it. Don't look at anywhere else. Don't go to other places. Why? Because this is the, we're talking about simplified. We're talking about doing things in a very straightforward way. We're talking about the least amount of complication. That's what they give you. There's a little search box. You type in the domain name you want, or just a word, or a couple of words. It will show you what's available. You check the little plus box, and that's it. They do the DNS for you, and I love their DNS service. It's really, really straightforward. It's really easy to update and add and change records. I mean, you can change records and you can change domain information for every domain that you have in your list. They've got a no charge Whois privacy. It doesn't renew. You know, it doesn't expire. It's just built into the service. You don't want it anymore. Just uncheck the box. It goes away. You want it. You check the box. You have it. They have unlimited domain forwarding. So if you have a domain and you just want it to point at your main domain, you don't even want to set up records for it or worry about any of that. You don't have to. And they do really, really great email hosting. Lots of great services over there. They handle transfers. They make renewals. In fact, the only time you ever hear from them is when your domain's up for renewal. They say, oh, it's up for renewal. That's it. You don't hear from them again. Love these guys. Great service. Couldn't be better. Hover.com/DanSentMe, or just use the code DanSentMe, 10% off. Done. That's it.
Done.
Simple.
They're good. I like them a lot.
Simple.
They get around with that.
Yeah, that could be their new thing.
All right. All right, got a quick question from Matt James a couple of weeks ago. Can Marco talk about how he does PR? I figured I'd bring this up since we were just talking about PR language. specifically, how do you send out press releases and to whom? Can they be unsolicited, or does that make people mad? So I've never sent a press release. I don't know anything about them. However, there was a very good discussion about this on Core Intuition episode 45 a few weeks ago. So if you... That's Daniel Jalgut and Manton Reese's podcast. Very good for developers to listen to. If you want to learn about press releases and sending them and how to do it and how not to do it and who to do it with and to, go listen to Core Intuition episode 45. And it's coreint.org. Another question from...
Coreint.org episode, you said...
45.
45. All right, put that into the show notes.
There's... I hope I'm pronouncing this name right. All right. Andrea Buchtel about the potential insecurity of Dropbox. He asks, every time Merlin, Marco, or Syracuse are mentioned using Dropbox, I think, really? Not that other syncing methods are faster or better, but Dropbox's holding of the encryption keys makes me very uncomfortable. Perhaps I'm overly concerned with the ramifications of Dropbox's security terms. Maybe there's a limit to what they're really willing to store on Dropbox. I guess what we as the hosts are willing to store on Dropbox.
Right.
So... The way I treat Dropbox, for the most part, is that I treat it as though it's nearly public. In the same sense that I treat things like on Facebook that are supposed to be private, but really, you know, in reality, you know that in the long run they probably aren't. So Dropbox to me is something that I consider to be nearly public, as in it's not like published on the internet all the time, but I don't put anything there that would be really disastrous if somebody else got a copy of it, or that I would really be, you know, embarrassed if somebody got a copy of it. So if I like took a naked picture of myself, I would not put it on Dropbox.
But you'd put that right on the Instapaper block.
I'd make it my avatar on Twitter. So you know, I'd want to control that. But you know, anything that's like really sensitive or extremely valuable or needs to be kept very secret, I wouldn't store on anybody else's servers. That to me seems ridiculous, unless I held encryption keys like with online backup products that I use. So the one thing that I think is weird that I put there by the standard is the 1Password database. Because 1Password, like many applications, uses Dropbox as its syncing backend service. And it gives me so much value and convenience to have that syncing via Dropbox that I'm willing to have the 1Password database there. Now, that sounds like a crazy thing because it sounds like, you know, that's a really high value security target. But I know that I have a very high security password as my main password for 1Password, and I know that they have gone through quite a lot of security auditing and good security design to ensure that their encrypted database files are really encrypted extremely well. And so I think if anybody did manage to hack into Dropbox, or if Dropbox decided to do something nefarious and look at my data themselves, and they found my 1Password file, I'm fairly confident that it wouldn't be of much use to anybody.
It sounds like this guy, though, what he's really worried about isn't that Dropbox itself will be like hacked and that a stranger will get the information. It sounds like his concern is that Dropbox themselves, because they hold the decryption encryption keys, that right. they themselves could, for whatever reason, you know, get in there and get stuff.
I mean, they could, and that's, you know, again, in my opinion, I'm fine with the Dropbox employee looking at my stuff in Dropbox. Now, I'd get upset if I learned that they did. You know, I would not be happy about that because they give us the illusion of privacy. So I would be very upset if that happened. However, it wouldn't be a disaster in my life. And I don't store anything there that could become a disaster in my life if Dropbox looked at it. And so I think that's generally how you should treat that kind of thing. You know, if you want something better encrypted than that, then use your own encryption before you put it there. Like maybe you store, and I haven't actually tried this. I don't know how the mechanics of this work in practice. Like if the uploads just get all messed up, but maybe you store an encrypted disk image on there. And you know, you just store important stuff in an encrypted disk image. I don't know. You can explore options like that, or just custom per file encryption schemes or encryption tools. That's how I would treat it if I wanted to put anything extremely sensitive and dangerous on there. But the more responsible solution, I think, is just to just not use it for that kind of thing. And so that's the real method I take. I would be curious to know how Merlin and Syracuse and the other people do that. You know, how they treat it, but you know, this is somebody's online service, and because it's designed in such a way that they can like share and redistribute files and everything, like it isn't just syncing between your computers. If that was the service, if that's all the service did, then they could do something like have you have a local encryption key that is never transmitted to the servers, and so the servers can't decrypt the files. Like, nobody on the service end could do it. That's where a lot of these online backup things work. Dropbox can't do that because they have all those features with the web interface and sharing files and public links and all this other stuff. And that's part of the reason why they have to do this, why they have to be able to go in and look at files and delete them, because a lot of people use it for piracy, for things that are illegal, like illegal things that even just illegal to possess, like child porn and like weapon type things. I don't know. So like they, because they have all this public sharing and stuff, they have to be able to look at what is hosted on their service, and they have to be able to block or delete files that are problematic for them. So I don't fault them for designing it the way it is designed, but I think as users, we have to be a little aware of that, and we just have to know what the potential here is. You know, the potential for the US government to compel Seagate to tell them what's on my hard drive and for them to be able to actually pull that off is pretty slim. The potential for anybody to send Dropbox a DMCA notice for a file, that's pretty high. And certainly anything hosted is more likely to be hacked by outsiders and accessed by outsiders, et cetera. So I'm really not, I'm not too worried about that, the way I use it. But you have to be careful how you use it. All right. So
are you concerned that somebody from, you know, a complete outside world, you know, a hacker will get in there and do something and see your stuff? Is that a concern to you? Or are you more in the same concept as this guy where it's more what will Dropbox do? What would the government do?
Right. It's more that. I mean, I'm not that concerned about hacking. I mean, at least in the traditional sense, that's up to Dropbox. And I think they're a they're such an incredibly high value target, and they're also so incredibly used by nerds and evangelized by nerds that I think they would take very, very good precautions to keep their servers from being hacked in traditional ways. Now, there's also the more recent redefinition of hacked, which really means somebody guessed my password or brute forced it. And of course, that's up to us. That's up to the user to have a password that that can't be easily brute forced or guessed, and to keep that password itself securely stored somewhere, either in our heads or, you know, don't just put on a post-it note, stuck to the monitor, visible to the whole office, that sort of thing. So, you know, and the way I use Dropbox, I use an extremely high security password for Dropbox itself because I know that my 1Password file is on there. So, in fact, my Dropbox password is more secure than my 1Password password. It is ridiculous. I think I made like the longest one they would accept. It's crazy how long that password is. And it's all random garbage. I have no idea what it is. So I think there are ways to use these things responsibly. But you can't use it for everything. And again, you know, if Dropbox is compelled to look at my files for legal reasons, or if some employee looks at them unscrupulously, I wouldn't be that concerned because I don't know what else. I don't know what they would really do with them that would be harmful. So I guess that's that topic. What do you think? Pretty much same thing?
Yeah, I mean, any time that I use an online service like that, especially like you know, it really is a target. I wouldn't put anything up there that, for me, I really treat it as like a place, an intermediate place where I can put stuff that I want on multiple computers. But almost everything that I do is relatively public on Dropbox. I mean, I'm with you. You have to think of it that way. Like, I think even if direct messages on Twitter are like, if somebody hacked my account and saw my direct messages, it'd be like me saying, email me at this, and it's Dan at one of my domains. Like, it's not secret. You know, I would not want to rely on something like a third party service like that for anything. Anything that was, like you're saying, you would really be destroyed. But I think there are a lot of people who do. I think for a lot of people, Dropbox is their vault. It is their security. You know, they believe it's super secure. They want it to be super secure. They treat it that way. And I think for all intents and purposes, it probably is secure in the way that they think it is. But it'll be big news if an ex-Dropbox employee, disgruntled employee, I mean, how long before that happens? How long before somebody with the potential to get access to those keys, you know, does something? And, you know, this is going to sound really silly, but I bet you that there's somebody out there who would pay money to a disgruntled Dropbox employee to get them in some capacity, sure. You know?
Yeah, if there was a high value enough target there,
yeah,
certainly.
Yeah. So,
you know, there's all the, like, the, I think the human factors, the social engineering and corruption, like the human version of corruption, not the Apple version of corruption.
Right.
You know, I think those are more likely to be avenues of attack for something that's reasonably well secured, like Dropbox.
Yeah.
That'd be far more likely, you know? So, and there's a related question too that I actually wasn't going to get to, but I figured I'd throw it in here now. A question from Christian Lindig, who said his last name is pronounced Lindig with Lin like in Linux, which I don't think is a good thing to tell people because the pronunciation of Linux is disputed. So Christian, I don't recommend that you tell people that's how you pronounce your name because true nerds will be even more confused. But anyway, he asks, for a small company, would you consider hosting proprietary source code in a private repository on GitHub or a similar service? Or would you rather have the code never leave your own servers? So in many ways, this is kind of the same question. It's very similar to what we were just talking about. And the answer here is that I use GitHub, and GitHub is extremely secure because as far as I know, they only do things with SSH keys. I don't think they use passwords for much of the code stuff with private things. I mean, that might just be for checkouts. Anyway, my GitHub password is also ridiculous. I don't even know what that is. I think the same kind of thing with GitHub, with, you know, you as a user are responsible for a lot of the security of that. I will also say, though, that the value of source code is not necessarily that high. Now, there are things in source code that you might have left in, like credentials for Amazon Web Services or something like that. That, you know, like if you left your S3 key in your source code somewhere, that could be a high value target for attack if it leaks and you don't change it. However, if you're just worried about your code itself being stolen and being like looked at by competitors and they're going to figure out how you do something, in almost all software industries, that's not going to do many people any good. Or it's not going to really do you a whole lot of harm. Because looking at, like, wasn't the Windows source code leaked like 5 years ago?
Yeah, it was. You're right. Yeah.
I mean, do you really think that did anything?
I haven't seen anybody coming out with a clone of Windows in the way that you would have thought it might have happened.
I mean, like, you know, source code leaks are, you know, it sounds like a huge deal. It sounds like somebody can just steal your business and that's it. However, I mean, there's a few things. One, source code is obviously protected by copyright. So if somebody did use your code or any really obvious derivatives of it, you could just sue them. Like it's not like they could take away your whole business forever and you'd be out of luck. Like, you know, there are legal protections in place there. It would also obviously be possession of stolen property, which is another problem. But you know, there's copyright issues there that would prevent somebody from directly ripping you off. And the other thing is there's two sides of this. One is that, you know, if someone steals your source code, they didn't steal the understanding of the source code. So, you know, what can they really pull out of that? Maybe they could pull out like one or two generic classes and make use of them, but like they're not going to take like your entire interface code and all like all the boring database accessing code and all that stuff. Like, that isn't stuff that people can really use very well outside of apps without just writing it themselves anyway. And that also isn't anything that's very unique to you. You know, again, like, you know, barring a few very proprietary and complex algorithms that most software doesn't have. But, like, you know, if you have your own custom algorithm for classifying some data and mathematics and patenting all this, you know, okay, yeah, maybe that can be high value. Most software doesn't have that, though. Most software is you know, the acronym, the CRUD acronym. You know, create, what's the R? Record, update, delete?
Create, read, update.
Read, delete. That's it. Yeah, right. Okay, so.
I like record. We could go with that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like most software is doing boring things in large quantities. And the way you assembled it, the way you assembled all your boring things together is what makes you valuable. If somebody steals your source code, they have a collection of boring things that they can't use. So it's not really that big of a problem. The other thing is, even if someone steals your source code, you still are your name and you still are the person or team that put that together. And there's a lot of present and future value to those things that nobody can steal from you unless they hire your entire team away from you and buy your trademark from you. But you know, they, like, if somebody stole Instapaper source code, they could make an app that looked a lot like Instapaper. That would be pretty bad, you know, in some ways. However, I could sue them for a lot of it. And even if they, you know, just use my source code as a reference to build their own legal source code that did a lot of things in similar ways I do my similar things, and it wasn't enough to really sue over, I'm still Instapaper. So that app will not have the reputation or the popularity or the name that I have. And that app doesn't have me to keep making it better. And without sounding too full of myself, there's value there to the team that created something, to the people who create and update and direct a product that people can't steal from you by copying some files. So in the grand scheme of things, I host a lot of my source code on GitHub because the level of security that it provides, in my opinion, is enough. You know, if somebody gets a hold of that, they're not going to be able to take down Instapaper, like the service. There's no credentials or anything important in there that they would have. They're not going to be able to to negatively affect my instance of the service, and they're not really going to be able to create a meaningful instance of their own. In fact, Readability has most of my website source code, and they used almost none of it, and that was part of our deal. But you know, they could have used a lot of it that they wanted to, and they ended up using almost none of it because it wasn't very useful to them. And their website they ended up creating, I'm pretty sure, uses none of my code at all, and not even anything close to it. Even what they were allowed to use, I'm pretty sure they used none of it. And that's a competitor. You know, like that's like what would happen if Readability got a copy of my iOS app code, which that was never part of the deal. But you know what would happen? Well, they would have a hard time keeping up updating their iOS app, which is kind of the situation they're in already. You know, nothing would really be that different. So really, this really isn't that big of a problem. So anyway, I use GitHub because it provides what I consider enough security for this type of asset.
Well, yeah, GitHub has had security issues.
They have. And you know what? When they had that most recent one, they dealt with it extremely well. They basically invalidated everybody's SSH keys. So you were forced to log in and change things. And you were forced to be notified of this problem. You know, if you're doing anything committing to your repository or trying to pull from it, you would know very quickly that you had to go change things. It was that, I think that was a very good response, what they did.
This is back, if this is the right one, the one you're talking about, March 4th, 2012, something. Public key security vulnerability and mitigation. And I mean, the problem that it was found was at 8:49 a.m. and at 9:53 a.m. is when they rolled out the fix. And then they apologized for it. And then they also updated their responsible disclosure policy, which they talked about as well, and updated that. I made that more public. I mean, that this is a company that very clearly, they take this kind of thing super, super serious. And I think that they're, you know, they understand because really they are developers, most of them there, and even the people high up in the GitHub company, they're really, really aware of how developers feel about this kind of thing. And I think that the silence is the worst situation. Once you've got it resolved, you know, these guys were totally open. When it comes to security, I mean, companies need to tell the people who use their service exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't need to get into the details of exactly, although GitHub kind of did. They said, oh, this is mass assignment vulnerability, and here's a big blog post about it in Rails and how it works. I mean, they got into that too. And this was like a 4-year-old problem. And this led to changing the way Rails handles mass assignments. And the Rails came out with a fix. I mean, all of that stuff is important. I put all this in the show notes. But looking at the way that GitHub handled it, yeah, we made a mistake. Here's the problem. Here's how we fixed it an hour later. Not every company can do that. And I think the bigger the company, the harder it is for them to, for whatever reason, the harder it is for them to handle it. I mean, GitHub, I don't know how many people they have working for them. But they obviously jumped on it. And you have to. You really have to. Like, I don't think a company should be afraid of looking bad that there was a problem discovered, or looking bad that, you know, that something like that happened. You know, this wasn't so much a problem with their code as it was a problem with the infrastructure, you know, the fact that it was a problem relating to Rails and that kind of thing. It wasn't like they just didn't think of this. It was an exploit, right. And they said, wow, we found out about it, we fixed it. And it's going to
actually, there was
it,
a much
it.
Worse problem with Dropbox a few months before that.
Which one?
I forget exactly when it was. There was a Dropbox security vulnerability.
Oh, right.
Maybe, I don't know, 6 months ago, something like that. Maybe even a year ago. It was a while. That they responded very badly to. And Hacker News and Slashdot got all over their case about it, because rightfully so, because I think they didn't. Notify people for a long time. or something like that. Like there was some issue with the way they didn't handle it very well. Actually, very similar to what just happened to LinkedIn. Didn't LinkedIn like not tell anybody about their passwords for a pretty long time?
Yeah.
So I mean, it's hard when you respond. When you don't respond, I think the reason why most of these companies who respond badly, the reason why they don't respond or take too long to respond, is because it's a really bad thing and they're trying to figure out what the heck to do. And it's tempting to just say, well, if we just kind of ignore it, it'll probably go away. And in reality, it usually doesn't. But I can see, like, there's a human behavioral thing that I think people are very willing to convince themselves that, oh, well, we don't want to draw attention to this. We don't want to, you know, draw too much negative attention to this. That'll make it worse. Let's just quietly fix it and we'll hope people didn't notice much and we'll hope people forget. And so, for somebody as big as LinkedIn or Dropbox, that doesn't work at all. But
I mean, even with you and the stuff you're doing, I could see there being privacy concerns with, you know, the kind of articles that people are reading and saving, right?
Sure. I mean, like I take security pretty seriously because I realize that people are creating a lot of data on my service. You know, they're creating a record of things they intend to read or did read. And you could probably tell a lot about a person by looking at that. I don't know. I don't do any kind of analytics like that because I don't have the time or the inclination to do that, or the ability for that matter. So like I'm not like behaviorally profiling my customers to try to figure out what ads I can serve them. Like I don't want to do that. I can't do that. So it's easy not to. But yeah, I don't know. Want to do one more sponsor?
Yeah, we can. We have a good one, great one actually, Squarespace. Squarespace.com. And these guys are a fully hosted, completely managed environment for creating a beautiful website or blog or portfolio. I use them personally. I use them for bigweek.co, the news site that I do. I do use them also for the 5x5 blog. And these guys just make it super simple and easy. You know exactly what your relationship with them is because you pay them. And then you get a website. And they have tons and tons of really awesome templates. If you go to squarespace.com, click on examples, and you can see an example, or really a dozen examples, across the board, no matter what it is you're doing. You're doing a design site, click the design and art tab, and you'll see some really, really cool examples of what you can do. Media and publishing, music, and even nonprofit stuff. And they've got some amazing templates that are already there. And all you need to do is just pick one of them, and you'll be blogging or you'll be publishing. And really amazing. They've got so many things built in. And that's what I love about it. Because honestly, I'd rather be spending my time on doing shows or working with sponsors or whatever. What I don't want to spend my time doing is like designing a site and figuring out how to integrate Twitter. That's a solved problem and I've let them solve it for me. I don't want to figure out what software I should be using to integrate a beautiful photo gallery or image gallery. They've done that. I'll just use theirs because it's great and it just works. And they're affordable too. You can start out, of course you can start out for free. But if you decide that you would like to sign up and pay, here's a code for you. It is Dan sent me 7, because this is the 7th month of the year. Dan sent me 7. You'll get 10% off. Now, if you sign up for their month-to-month thing, it's $10 a month. If you sign up for their annual thing, it's $8 a month. And you get a free domain name, custom domain name, your own, when you do that. If you sign up for longer, you can go to their unlimited plan. It's still only $16 a month. And you still get 10% off additional if you use Dan Sent Me 7. So please do go check these guys out. I love them. I hope that you will too. I'm done building, you know, like blogs and that kind of stuff. They just do it better. Check them out, squarespace.com.
I made a weird decision this past week. I was doing something on the servers. I'm working on a new text parser and a new protocol for the app to communicate with the server to be a lot more efficient about how it does that.
Oh, cool.
And one of the things that made this a lot easier was to end support in the API, in my private API, for a very, very old version of the text parser and a very old version of the protocol that the Instapaper free app uses. So the Instapaper free app stopped working last week.
Ooh.
And there was another reason to do this too, which is that that private API that it used has been scraped like crazy by other clients on Android and Windows Phone that don't use my subscriber API. They just scrape the private API that my app uses. And that bugs the crap out of me.
Mm.
And I can put various protections in place so my app communicates via OAuth and there's other protections that are in place. But those weren't in place back when Instapaper Free was last updated. So I decided that to both cut down on the massive resource demands and the competitive inconveniences that people's app scraping or that their API scraping apps cause. Because that, you know, that sucks for apps that try to use the real API, the officially supported API.
Right.
And they have to compete with these that are scraping my private API and avoiding the requirements of being a subscriber and everything. Like, you know, that sucks for them, for those developers. And it also sucks for me because I'm paying a lot of money to support all that from people who are just ripping me off. But also, you know, the main reason I chose to do this now is because I'm making all these back-end changes. And so anyway, I was able to delete and stop supporting a whole bunch of old legacy, very, very slow code. By ending this support for Instapaper Free. And I was curious if this would cause any meaningful feedback or any backlash, really.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I officially pulled Instapaper Free from the store a little over a year ago. But I had pulled it in various, like 2 week windows here and there at experimentation. I had pulled it numerous times before that. So it hasn't really been in the store at all for over a year, and it's been almost 2 years since it's been available reliably. And so I figure most people who are still using Instapaper Free today, if you're still using an app like that hasn't been even available for over a year, and possibly much longer than that, I figure you probably use Instapaper enough that if I tell you that's no longer being supported, please buy the paid app. That's not that ridiculous of a thing to be told. And it turns out, I've asked my support guy about this, and I've looked at some feedback myself, and it turns out that almost nobody has noticed and written in about it. And the people who have written in, who the support guy has told, you know, well, it's no longer supported, you know, here's the full app, they've been like, okay. So it seems like this is an okay time to end support for this. But I've kind of been dreading this day for the last year or so. I knew at some point I would move on with the server code and I would end the support for this old code. But I really didn't think I could do it within the next couple of years.
It kind of sounds like almost like the way you're describing it, if you feel like you got away with something.
I do. I really do. I mean, I really think that I got away with this about a year earlier than I thought I would be able to. So I'm very happy about that. And it's great because it's going to make... I can probably drop an entire server if I wanted to.
Oh, like, wow.
That's how much resource usage this is going to save, because not only am I cutting out all those scraper apps, because not a lot of people are still using Instapaper Free, really. It was mostly it was all those scraping apps. Not only do I cut all that out, but the code that was running that was much less efficient than my newer code, and which is one of the biggest reasons I am cutting it out. The code that's running that was so much less efficient that, like, serving one free user was actually more expensive than serving one paid app user. And by a good amount. So that's all done, and I'm glad to be done with it. All right, one more. I guess two more things. I'll do a quick one since we don't have that much time left.
Sure.
I tried. This has nothing to do with anything. Total non sequitur here. All right. I tried Amazon Cloud Search a couple of weeks ago, or about a month ago now. Are you familiar with this? It's one of their relatively new Amazon Web Services. I think it's only been out for like 2 months. And it is literally hosted search indexing.
I heard about it when it came out, but I didn't. It's billed by time, right? Like it's like an hour.
Yeah, you basically... it's so behind the scenes, it basically is just creating EC2 instances for you that run this search software on them, and you have no control over that. And it just bills you for, like, it runs as many as it thinks it needs, and then it bills you for the hours those instances are on. So you're basically being billed for usage, but in kind of a weirdly controlled way. And it makes sense. And, you know, the reason why this is interesting is because search is extremely hard to do yourself. And it's very, very easy to outsource usually. You know, with the way most data and workflows work, it's very, very easy to outsource search to some other service or some other servers. So Cloud Search, you know, this was very interesting to me because right now I host the whole subscriber search and it's well over 200 gigs of content after being indexed and compressed. Mm. It's quite a lot of content that I'm indexing and searching. And the search volume that I have is actually pretty low. People don't usually search for much. Like I have way less than one search per second running combined. So I was very interested in outsourcing this because it cost me like $2,000 a month to host this myself. And you know, because you have to have at least two servers to do it, because it takes a very long time to build the index. So you have to have like a very basic level of redundancy. And when you're indexing that much data, you need a lot of disk space, and it has to be reasonably fast. And you need, you know, at least some RAM to be able to do that. And you need some pretty good CPUs to have fast indexing. So you need pretty good hardware. They're like high-end database servers, really, to have a search server with that much load on it. So looking at Cloud Search, I actually spent like a week and a half re-implementing the entire search backend with Cloud Search, which is not that easy, but you know, I did it. I thought it was worth it. And when I finally started doing, you know, I was importing segments of data first. First, I did like only my data. And then I would do like, you know, user ID ranges and post ID ranges to just try to import them, see how it goes.
Yeah.
The problem I ran into is that it doesn't actually store anything useful on disk, as far as I can tell. It seems like Cloud Search stores the entire index in RAM on those EC2 instances.
Wow.
When you have 200 gigs of searchable data, Amazon very quickly starts adding instances that it's using. And again, you can't tell it to use fewer. You can just delete data out of your index and it will automatically scale itself down. So once I had spent a good amount of time and money on these EC2 instances, I realized this. You know, I extrapolated out based on this, and I saw this was going to cost something like $20,000 a month for my usage.
My God.
And I was like, all right, well, that's not going to work. So I deleted the whole thing, shut the whole thing down, stopped adding things to it, and I emailed them because they have like, you know, an email us for pricing info for large usage.
Right.
I emailed them saying like, hey, you know, is there anything we can do here? You know, am I doing something wrong? Is there, you know, am I using this grossly inefficiently? Or does this just really not work for my kind of data? And so we went back and forth a couple times. You know, I sent them my schema. I sent them some sample indexing data. And it basically, the result was, no, there's nothing I can do. It's just, I have way too much data for that. You know, Cloud Search was designed for things that can be fit into RAM economically. So it makes a lot of sense for Amazon, for their kind of searching. They're searching, for the most part, I mean, they're pretty big, but if you think about like what an online store has to search, an online store has to do a lot of different facets on each record. It has like, you know, sort by price, sort by feature, sort by brand, all these different like sorting, these sorting features and filters and everything on a relatively small data set. You know, for most online stores don't have gigs and gigs of product text to be searching. They have maybe a few megs at most. And that would be a big store. So, you know, it makes sense why it's designed the way it is. And because it's all in RAM, it can do a lot of things very, very well, such as all those facets. It also does updates very well if your records are changing a lot. And it's also very fast to search. to query the index. But what I'm doing is the opposite of that. What I'm doing is massive amounts of text being indexed, very few fields, no advanced filtering needed really beyond the very basics. And once a record is inserted, it's almost never updated. It can occasionally be deleted. Even that's pretty rare. But for the most part, I'm just adding to a giant index and with a very low search volume. And so it just doesn't work for indexes like that. I think the same thing would be true if you had like an online forum and you were trying to build like a search for the forum that didn't suck. I think Cloud Search would also fail for that. But it would be fine for like if I wanted to do like a search on marker.org on my blog, it'd be fine because that's a relatively small amount of data. So even though it's not optimized for that kind of model, it'd be so little data that it wouldn't matter. You know, I would be well under the minimum for one instance, and it'd be something like, I don't know, $80 a month. I don't know, whatever the minimum is. So clearly this is a good product for a lot of types of searches, but not mine. So I went back to Sphinx Search and just rewrote a little bit of it and started using the real-time indexes, and that sucks. So now I'm doing something else. So I'll have more to talk about in Search once I figure out what works best. But I can tell you that Cloud Search, for this kind of model of lots of data with low query volume, does not work well at all. Or rather, is so ridiculously priced that it's impractically expensive.
Who do you think is using this set? I mean,
well, again, I think if you have the kind of set that Amazon has, like reasonably small amount of text, but lots of different facets and a lot of updates on that data, that would make a lot of sense. Like that, I can see it being very useful in a case like that. But when you're indexing lots and lots of text for infrequent searches, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So that's why I can't use it. I think forums couldn't use it. Any kind of like user created content site where there's like a lot of text, like Tumblr couldn't use it. That's for sure. Just a lot of like any kind of like large text use, it'd be bad for. But if you're doing a lot of things that are either small text or that don't involve text, like number filtering and ranging and things like that, that are useful, like a store, then you can use it. All right, I think we're good.
Is that all you got?
I think we're good for the week. Yeah, I don't want to butt into Merlin's time too much, and I'm done for the day. So, let's call this done, and I can get my chicken salad sandwich of the day. Okay. I have chicken salad almost every day because it's amazing. It's the best food.
Okay. Well, if you want, you can follow Marco on Twitter, Marco Arment. You can check out Instapaper, WeDon'tSay.com. I'm Dan Benjamin on Twitter. You can see all the notes, links, and everything that we saved for this show by going to 5x5.tv/buildanalyze/85. We also have links to our sponsors there with information about the promo codes and all that good stuff. And of course, please rate the show in iTunes. It's the best way to help us promote the show, to help us get new listeners. It means a great deal. You can just go in there and click the star that you feel it deserves. If you want, you can leave a longer review. And we appreciate that. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can go to 5x5.tv/contact. And if you mark it as private, it will actually mark it as private or not.
Oh, good. That's fixed.
Fixed.
I love how you sent the mass email to your hosts to alert us that this change was made. The mass email went to me and John Syracuse.
The only ones that care.
That was awesome.
Yeah. So you've got that now. So anyway, thanks everybody for listening. And of course, we do appreciate that feedback and the ratings and everything else. Hopefully we will be able to respond on the air as Marco often does. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next week.